It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. That's the weekend looming ahead already up there. You know, I was looking at the calendar today. It's only three weekends before Christmas, so it gets a little hectic. Yeah. Another wintry day. How about that snow that picked up yesterday afternoon, huh? Well, that just flurries up until about 1:30, 2 o'clock, and then the heavens opened up. We may see that again this afternoon, too. So keep an eye on that for you. It's an Ask the Lawyer Day today. We'll meet our local attorney in just a moment. Later on the program, we're going to be talking about keeping a healthy gut during the holiday season. Maybe not the most pleasant thing to talk about, but hey, it happens, right? Because so many of us eat a lot over the holidays, starting Thanksgiving and then running right through New Year's. So we'll talk about that with a gastroenterologist. Her name is Dr. Samantha Nazareth. She'll be visiting with us by telephone. We'll get some tips on keeping your gut healthy over the holidays. We'll also be talking about digital devices later on the program today with guest Nicole Dreisky. But our first guest is with us here in the studio. It's local attorney Elizabeth Smith. Attorney Smith, good to see you. Nice to have you here.
Oh, good to be back.
Yes, we talked. We were trying to remember here a couple of minutes ago. We were chatting. It's been a while since you were here, but it's good to see you again. Attorney Smith's practice focuses a lot on Social Security issues, the legalities around Social Security. So if you have questions about that, feel free to give us a call. We'll open up the phone lines here momentarily at 283-2525. I suppose the first question a lot of people might ask who don't have personal knowledge of this is, well, you know, what's the big deal? Why do you need a lawyer for Social Security? Don't you just sign up when you're eligible and that's it? Well, there's different kinds of Social Security, right?
Right. There's the retirement program, mm-hmm. which typically you do not need an attorney for unless there's a problem with perhaps your earnings history or the way that they pay it out. Then there's Social Security disability, which if you worked and then became disabled and you paid into the system when you worked to get that money back out, then there's supplemental security income if you're low asset, low income, and you meet the medical definition of disabled, you could receive benefits. And then one of the often overlooked groups is benefits for children, whether the child is disabled or the child is beneficiary on a parent's claim, whether the parent is disabled or the parent is retired or the parent is deceased. Mm-hmm. So Social Security actually encompasses a number of individuals in the United States.
We sometimes hear the term SSI. Which one is that?
SSI is Supplemental Security Income. So if you are low asset and low income and you meet the definition of disabled, you could be eligible for SSI. The other thing with SSI, when we talk low asset, low income, people think, well, I have a house or I have a car, so therefore I'm not eligible. You can have a house, you can have one car, you can have no more than $2,000 loose, so to speak, in a bank account. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have clients who have cash values on life insurance policies, those types of things, but you have to be under that $2,000 amount. And you also, in terms of your income, need to be below, I like to tell people below $1,100 a month, but it's actually $1,190 a month. So if you're low asset, low income, and you meet the definition of disability medically for Social Security, in Pennsylvania, it's paying right now $750 a month. But in 2019, there's going to be a cost of living adjustment, 2.8%. So beginning in January, that monthly amount for an individual will be going up to $771 a month. And if you have a married couple who are both on SSI, that will go from $1,125 a month. In 2019, it will go up to $1,157 a month. So some a little bit of an increase for folks who would be eligible for SSI.
Obviously, this gets a little complex, even in your cursory explanation there. You know, it gets a little foggy for a lot of people. Other than the Social Security for retirement income, that's pretty straightforward, and that's the one that most, when you say Social Security, that's what most people think about.
Right.
You usually don't need an attorney for that, right? I mean, you can just, in fact, you can do that online these days, I understand.
You can do most programs online except for SSI. There are some issues with retirement at times, and at times you may need to have an attorney involved, but typically you do not. Mm-hmm. I sometimes will help prior clients of mine do the application for the retirement online. One of the things that I'll just as an aside, we'll talk a minute about with retirement is if you go to their website, ssa.gov, one of the best websites out there, talks about all of the different Social Security programs. But if you scroll down on the first page, it has an estimator. What is going to be your retirement age? But also, what is going to be, how are you going to maximize your Social Security benefits? Candidly, it's 70 for most people who are, you know, 55 and below. But I was at a store not too long ago, and they said, oh, Elizabeth Smith, Social Security, when am I supposed to retire? I said, go back, look on the computer. And he came back out, and he said, oh, man, I got to work 7 more years.
So that website, SSA, that stands for Social Security Administration.
Correct.
In case you're wondering, listeners. SSA.gov, is that what it is?
.gov.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if you have any questions here, I mean, I've got a ton of them, but if you have questions or comments, feel free to join us at 283-2525. Now, we always caution you when we're having an Ask the Lawyer Day that any advice that's offered on the program should not be relied upon by listeners. I mean, you know, everyone has their own situation, and you really need to consult with your own attorney if you have specific problems. But we'll certainly try to give some general advice to you and hopefully help you along the way. So 283-2525. You mentioned one aspect of Social Security, one facet of it that is seldom talked about, most people don't even know about, is for children who, for one reason or another, I'm familiar with this only because I had a fraternity brother when I was in undergraduate school. In fact, he was a very close friend of mine from the Pittsburgh area, who was getting Social Security. You know, we were in college, but his father had died some years previously, and he qualified for that particular benefit, and that helped him pay his college tuition. You know, it was very important to him. Many of these decisions are life changing. If you apply for some of these benefits, if you get them, it's life-changing, and if you don't get them, it's life-changing. I take it that other than Social Security retirement benefits, some of these other ones are a little bit difficult to get. Does the Social Security Administration look you over pretty carefully before they approve these payments?
I would say yes. They have certain guidelines, the thing called the regulations, a thing called the listings, and they want to be sure that the person that they would be awarding benefits to meets the standards that have been set. That's probably one of the reasons why at the initial level you see such a number of denials. Again, 87% of people going in receive a denial at that initial level.
That's what I've heard, which is, it's a pretty astonishing number when you think about it. 87, like, for example, SSI, 87% of people who apply are initially denied?
87. And, you know, one of the problems with that is sometimes it's just because they didn't complete things fully, or maybe a good example would be somebody applies and then they stop in the process. Maybe they're having some difficulty. But also, a number of people come to me and they'll say, well, I got the letter. It said I wasn't eligible, so I didn't do anything, but I didn't get any better. And I say, well, you have to appeal. Just because Social Security said that you weren't disabled doesn't mean that that's the final determination. Mm-hmm. And so many people just will make that decision. And candidly, I think Social Security's counting on that.
Yeah.
That people just are going to try and work, see if they get better, but many of them don't.
If you are initially denied and you decide that you want to appeal, if you know about it, first of all, if you know you can appeal, mm-hmm. that's probably where an attorney becomes pretty much a necessity, right?
Right. You have 60 days from the date of the denial to ask for a hearing before an administrative law judge. And an appeal gets filed, or a request for hearing, and then what happens is when you're evaluating the case, because it takes 12 to 18 months to get to a hearing before a judge, with an attorney looking at a case, they can see where the strengths and weaknesses are. For instance, I had a case not too long ago where the claimant was saying to me, and the claimant is the person who's claiming benefits, that she had fibromyalgia, but her PCP was treating it. And I said, well, my experience at Social Security with the administrative law judge is you need to be treating with a rheumatologist. You need a specialist. Is that what the regulations say? No, but is that the reality of the system? Yes, that's the reality of the system, that they want to see treatment by specialists. The other thing that an attorney will do besides helping to develop the case is collect the records, review the records, see if there's any anomalies out there. For instance, I had a case this year where in the record it said that my client worked, and I called her up and I said, hey, what do you mean you worked? You're applying for benefits, and you can work while you're applying. You have to make below a certain dollar amount. But she swore up and down that she didn't work. Well, here the doctor had mixed her record with somebody else's record, and we thought that the way that a judge would look at it was that she was working, that it was going to be a problem. That's something a claimant wouldn't know if they had, these records were submitted. Also, there's certain legal arguments that can be made in terms of onset dates, in terms of listings, in terms of one of the real difficult cases is hearing loss cases and also vision loss cases. And you really need to have some expertise when moving forward with those types of cases.
We're talking with attorney Elizabeth Smith. Her practice focuses a lot on Social Security issues. By the way, your office is in Cranberry, right?
Yes, in Cranberry for the past year.
Mm-hmm. And people just come to you. I mean, they don't have to be referred or anything, right?
Right. So my primary office is in Cranberry. I do have a satellite office in Butler, and people either call me, they can go online to my website and do an intake on the website. We even text with people. We do consults in person. We do them by Zoom call. We do them over the phone. I have a visit. I'm going to Beaver County in 2 weeks to somebody who's a young man who's in a nursing home. So any which way we can get to somebody to try to do a consultation and evaluate the claim, make some recommendations and see if we can help them move forward with the process.
And under some circumstances, you might advise people that you don't have a legitimate claim here. You're probably not going to win this.
Yes. Because, you know, number one, I have an ethical duty to pursue valid claims. Two, when you look at it, I know what the law provides, and they may not have the facts to support the case. Now, and what I tell potential clients, claimants, is this is my opinion. However, another attorney may have another opinion. But I don't take every case that comes in, just like most attorneys don't take every case that comes in. One of the things that is a bit different with a Social Security case than a typical law case, Social Security cases are done on contingent fee basis, which means I don't get paid unless I get money for the claimant. So I take the case and I don't get any money up front. We go to the hearing, and if there's a favorable decision, then I would be paid out of the back benefit award. And if there's not a favorable decision, then I don't get anything. So especially for indigent folks, let's face it, folks who have worked but are unable to work because of their impairment, they don't have money to pay for an attorney. The contingent fee way, which is adopted by the administration, it is really an easy way for folks to have access to justice.
I'm guessing there are many listeners who are tuned in right now, Attorney Smith, who didn't even realize that if you became disabled one way, if you were working and became disabled, lost your vision, lost your hearing, whatever, that you were eligible for Social Security. I'm sure there were people who didn't even know that.
I'm meeting with a young woman after this program who stopped working in 2014, bachelor's level executive, and she said, nobody even told me about it. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Here it is 4 years later, and I said, wow, what are you waiting for? Now we're going to have to go back and try to find this evidence of when you first became disabled, which becomes, those types of cases become a bit more difficult. They're doable, and they're cases that can be won. But one of the biggest mistakes that I see that people make is that they don't apply.
Just pick up that conversation in a minute here. I hate to keep anybody waiting if they have a question for us. So let's go to the phones. The phone number is 283-2525. If you have questions here, 283-2525. Caller, this is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Smith.
Hi, I'm sorry I have a cold, but I heard you say that, you know, a lot of people weren't aware that if they were disabled at any age, they could apply for disability through the Social Security Administration. But I wanted to point out that a lot of people aren't aware that you can get health insurance before any disability just by applying for Medicaid. In 2014, when the state took the Medicaid expansion money, it allowed even single men, head of households, if they were lost income, they can get health insurance, not through health.gov, but through the state welfare offices. They can get very good health insurance. And I think what happened in 2014 and prior to that, the reason for that 86% of people being denied, they only wanted health insurance because SSI only pays, am I correct, around $700 a month?
It pays $750. You're right.
Okay, so people were applying for SSI hoping that a minute disability, they would be approved, just not for the money, because that isn't a lot of money. They were really wanting to get health insurance. So now people should be aware that even single men who couldn't get health insurance prior to 2014 can now get health insurance just by applying through the state human services department in down on Hollywood Drive.
That's a good point. I appreciate you bringing it up, sir. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Brian.
Sure. Phone number is 283-2525. I'm not sure we're talking about exactly the same thing there, though, because Social Security disability income can be, I mean, you can use that for anything, right? I mean, it's not just for medical costs.
Right. I think what the caller was referring to, those when someone is not working and they have, again, low asset, low income, before 2014, there was some problem with health insurance, access to health care. That changed in 2014, where such people could then get health insurance through the state. And one of the big things with a Social Security case, whether it's an SSI or an SSD case, is you have to have medical evidence to win a case. And if you don't have medical evidence or medical insurance, then how do you get medical evidence?
You wouldn't have the money to see a doctor.
Right.
I see.
Unless you have a spouse or a family member who's carrying you on their health insurance.
Well, that's a great point, then, that caller brought
yes,
up.
Yes, yes.
Very excellent point. Appreciate you joining us on that, sir. Phone number is 283-2525. If you have questions here, obviously this gets a little bit complex. 283-2525, 283-2525. And I'm sure a lot of people get frustrated and angry when they think they have a legitimate claim and they get denied by the Social Security Administration, right?
People who are angry when they get denied, especially when I see all income levels. I have had individuals who have worked hard their entire life, made $100,000, $125,000, and their body's given out on them. And they're having to go through this process and go through these doctor's appointments, and everything is looked at with a fine-tooth comb. And I've had, in the lifestyle, of course, that they live, they cannot keep. But the things that they used to love to do, they can no longer do, because of their medical problems, because of the functionality limitations. But even low-income folks, they also, they're not able to afford even the basics. And again, you know, cancer knows everyone. I mean, there's no, it hits everyone, no matter the age, no matter the economic class, and so it really, it can be a difficult process, and individuals can get very upset, and rightly so. And I think one of the things is the length of time that it takes to get through the process, from an initial application to a hearing. Right now, you're looking at probably 24 months. That's the initial app, get denied, 12 to 18 months before you get to a hearing before an administrative law judge.
Seems like an incredibly long time. How come it takes a year and a half to get a hearing?
Not enough money funding Social Security, turnover, judges retiring. Then they would hire judges, and then not enough staff.
But in the meantime, this person is not getting any money.
Right, right.
I mean, depending on their situation, that could be, they may not be able to make it a month and a year and a half.
There are some folks out there, Dave, who will say that Social Security or the government's doing this on purpose. I don't believe it necessarily, but you know that they're going to starve you to make you work, to go back out and work. And that's a conversation I would probably have with at least half of my clients at some point. I have a cell phone bill to pay. I have to pay the electric. I have to pay car insurance. My family will only give me so much. You know, there's some great programs locally, nationally, that will help individuals while you're waiting during this process. But people who don't have anyone, it's a long and lonely road. It really is.
Does the amount that you would be able to receive under Social Security Disability, SSD, or SSI, does the amount that you would be eligible to receive dependent on how much you were earning when you were working?
SSI's straight 750, or it's going up, as I said, I think to 790.
No matter what you are earning.
Yeah, because, right. So if you're low asset, low income, and you don't have enough quarters of coverage, you're going to be SSI. SSD is based on what you earn, but once you make, let's say you made $120,000 a year, the most you're going to receive in Social Security Disability is going to be about $2,400. If you made over that, you're not going to receive anything above that. There's a cap on that.
Is there any sort of a threshold that if you made more than that, you wouldn't be eligible for anything?
No. There's no, I mean, you're eligible, but only up to that certain dollar amount.
Some people have argued for that, you know, mm-hmm. given the financials, another kettle of fish, but it's kind of related. You know, we hear constantly about how both Social Security and Medicare are in trouble financially and something has to be done, and some people have suggested, I guess it's called a means test.
Right.
You know,
right.
Where if you were let's use an extreme example. If you were a millionaire, then you wouldn't be eligible for Social Security because, you know, you already have enough money. What do you need to take more out of Social Security for? But that doesn't apply to anything we're talking about here.
No, no. But when you say that Social Security's in trouble, in 1940, the life expectancy of a 65-year-old was 79 years of age. Today, the life expectancy of a 65-year-old is to 85. So people are living longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you have that jump. And so Social Security's having to pay out for these number of individuals who are living longer. By the Social Security, and looking at their website this morning, I pulled a figure. By the year 2035, the number of Americans 65 years of age and older will increase from the 49 million that we have today to over 79 million.
Ooh, wow.
So
that's the back end of the baby boomers, I guess, there.
Right, right. Yeah.
If you have questions, folks, you can feel free to give us a call, questions or comments, 283-2525, 283-2525, talking about Social Security issues, SSD, SSI. Don't want to use the fancy terms, but that's shorthand for the different types of Social Security. 283-2525, Attorney Elizabeth Smith is our guest. Her practice focuses a lot on Social Security issues. You mentioned age 65. When Social Security was approved, and this is back in the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and it was part of the New Deal, right? They didn't just pick age 65 out of thin air, from what I read. I mean, I'm no great historian on Social Security, but I've read about it. They picked that age because, I hate to sound morbid, but they didn't think a whole lot of people would live much past 65, so
right.
They wouldn't be paying out, you know, they wouldn't be shelling out these benefits for too long,
right?
If people weren't eligible until they were 65. As you said, that has changed markedly. Were these other types of Social Security, SSI, SSD, were they part of the program originally, or were they added in later on, you know?
I do not know the answer to that.
My guess is they were probably added in later on.
From what I recall from a conference I went to, I believe more like into the 60s is when the programs were added.
Sounds more like Great Society stuff and Lyndon Johnson administration.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things in talking about Social Security disability, if someone is looking to apply or looking how they can have the best opportunity to receive benefits to get that favorable decision, I often tell individuals to go to the local dollar store and buy themselves a calendar and keep track of every appointment that they have with every doctor, every MRI, every blood work, lab work that they have done, so that they're able to go back, because Social Security is going to want to see those medical records to make sure that you know who you've been to see, when you were to see that person, and be sure that that evidence is going to be submitted with your case, but also to let your primary doctor, whoever is the lead doctor on your case, so it may be your rheumatologist, it may be the cardiologist, it may be your PCP, is to clue them in initially that this is what you're doing. One of the biggest problems that I have with my clients is when they go in to see their doctor, they tell their doctor that they're fine. Well, I say to my clients, if you're going to see the doctor, other than for your physical, your annual physical, you're not fine, and you need to say what's the matter. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't, the record reads everything's good. So I have Social Security administrative law judges say to me, oh, well, that says that he was fine. There was no change in his condition. And meanwhile, when they're in my office or they're on the phone with my assistant Anna or my assistant Valerie, they'll be like, oh, I couldn't get out of bed for 2 days. I believe them to be true, but if they don't tell their doctor, then it's not in the medical record. And then the judge is like, well, they're not telling the doctor, then, you know, really, is there a problem there?
Let me talk a little bit about, because you've used the term, low asset, low income. Am I remembering that correctly? Mm-hmm. Low asset, low income. So when you're submitting your information, when you're applying, submitting a claim, you need documentation for this sort of stuff, like how many things you own, what's the value of the property that you own, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, typically if with a SSI application, you're going to do a phone interview, and they will go through that with you and try to determine what there is, and then they do a computer search. And that's oftentimes one of the biggest things that keeps people ineligible for SSI benefits is they have a whole life insurance policy that's valued at more than $2,000. And so they have to do something with that before they're going to even go forward with their SSI application. Or I'll give you another example. I had a lady, she had three cars. I'm like, there's only one person in your house driving. Get rid of the other two cars. Then you're down to one car and you're otherwise going to be eligible to apply.
Does Social Security, this is a phone interview with somebody from Social Security, I guess?
Yes.
Do they ask you what kind of car you have? I mean, does it make a difference whether you've got an old Studebaker or a brand new Cadillac?
One car. Doesn't matter.
Just one car, huh?
One car.
But you can own a house, right?
Can own a house.
Yeah. Do they ask you, you know, is this a shack or, you know, is it $500,000 house?
They don't ask.
Just do you own a house, huh?
Do you own a house. But that's for SSI. But, you know, when you look at the big picture, and I think one of the misconceptions out there is that people are living off of Social Security. $750 a month income for SSI with medical benefits, which has some value. The average Social Security disability claim pays about $1,471 a month. Even if you're at the max, call it $2,300 a month. That's pretty difficult if you have a family. And even if you add on to that, okay, so they have some benefit, they have some health benefits. I don't know how you're really living off of that.
Yeah.
You're barely making it.
It's like our previous caller said, $750 a month is not all that much. Questions, comments, 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Attorney Elizabeth Smith is with us. Her practice focuses a great deal on Social Security issues, 283-2525. Would you talk about a disability if you're applying for Social Security disability? Are there degrees of disability that they're going to be looking at? For example, vision loss. I mean, could you be visually impaired, not necessarily blind? Or if you had a physical disability, you know, in terms of walking or something like that. In other words, are they looking for a degree of disability similar to what you might see in a veteran's pension or something like that?
They don't break it down quite that way. They break the body down into 14 different parts. And so whether you have cardiac or you have mental health or you have musculoskeletal, there's going to be objective standards. And if you meet those objective standards, there could be a finding of disabled. What I think you're getting at, Dave, is more of what they would call a residual functional capacity. So Social Security will say, we're going to look at a person's age. If you're under 50, pretty difficult to get benefits. 50 to 54, a little bit easier. 55 and above, the easiest age group. They're going to look at education. If you have a high school education or more, that includes a GED, a little bit more difficult to get benefits. If you have less than a high school education, and I have a number of clients who are 8th, 9th, 10th grade who had to quit school to work to help the family, becomes a little bit easier. They look at work experience. What kind of work did they do? Did they do skilled work, semi-skilled work, unskilled work? They look at exertion level. What kind of work did they do? Were they doing the heavy work? Were they doing medium work, like where they were having to lift up to 50 pounds for a third of the day? Were they doing light work or sedentary work? And what's the combination of that? And then based on how much you can sit, stand, walk, lift, carry, how does that play into those other factors as well? And so it becomes, when you get to that residual functional capacity, when you're looking at those five areas, you do get to some degree, I would say.
This, again, a lot of folks, I would dare say the majority of people, this is going to make their eyes glaze over. Really. I'm serious. Well, for example, your term residual functional capacity. I don't consider myself a dummy, but I hear you say that, and I say, what? Residual functional capacity. What the heck does that mean? And you know, if you're trying to submit a claim for Social Security disability, I mean, it makes my head spin. You know, I can't even get past that.
Well, you know, people, especially claimants who don't have representation, they go into a hearing and a judge says, why can't you work? And said, well, I have depression and I have a bad back. Well, you know what, that's 80% of the workforce, and on a given day that could be you and that could be me. But we don't have the functional limitations that maybe the person next to us has in terms of the back. There may be such severe pain, there may be neuropathy that keeps them from sitting too long. I had a hearing on Tuesday, a young man who cannot sit for more than 5 minutes and goes numbness down the right leg and into the left buttocks. He actually, his most comfortable position is kneeling. So he has a back problem. You have a back problem, but you have the ability to function with that back problem.
He doesn't.
And same thing with mental health. Everybody gets depressed now and then, but is it a depression that you stay in bed? Or is it a depression where you're a little bit blue because it's the holidays?
If you are approved for a Social Security disability benefit or Social Security SSI benefit, is it reviewed by the government periodically, or are you good to go, you know, for the rest of your life? I don't mean to make light of it, but you understand what I'm saying.
Well, I know what you're saying, and...
I mean, do they come around and check on you in 5 years, for example, you know?
Well, when someone's approved, there's the possibility that the appeals council will just pick a case and review it. Mm-hmm. And I've had that happen with several of my clients, and they've said, oh, no, the judge did the right thing. Person's entitled. But they do have reviews, and so every 2 to 3 years, claimants will get documents from Social Security saying it's now time to review your case, and we're going to take a look at the medical evidence to see if you continue to meet the definition of disabled. I will tell you that in the past 5 years, I have seen quite an increase in the number of what they call them cessation cases. And I'm glad you brought this up because let's say, Dave, you were receiving Social Security disability. And let's say they notified you and they wanted to review your case. And maybe you're working a little bit and your doctor's thinking that you're doing okay. And so Social Security sends you a letter and they say, we find that you're able to work, and so we're going to cease or we're going to end your benefits. What happens is you have 10 days, not 10 business days. You have 10 days.
10 days, and it takes them 18 months to get a hearing for you.
You have 10 days to get to the Social Security office and elect to continue your benefits and file an appeal. Well, if you don't check your mail every day, you're in trouble. Yeah. And then it's the whole appeal process all over again. And cessation cases are really, really difficult cases because people sometimes slack off on the treatment a little bit. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're really sick and can't get there. But it's that 10-day, and so when I get those kinds of calls in our office, we call those people back immediately and just say, you have to find somebody to take you to the office. Do not take the paperwork home. Do not let – you need to sit down and complete it, because if not, you're going to be losing your monthly money and you're going to be losing your insurance.
Now, when you say take that to the office, you're talking about the nearest Social Security office?
The nearest Social Security office, yes.
And by the way, folks, sometimes you got kind of a wait when you get into a Social Security office.
40 minutes up to – the longest I've waited was 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got chairs in there and everything, but you can plan on waiting for a little while. You've mentioned an administrative law judge. Am I using the right? I'm taking notes here while you're talking. An administrative law judge who presides over these hearings. Who are these people? Is it just one, or is it, what's the legal term, on bank or whatever it is? Is it a group of three judges that hears these cases, or who is it?
An administrative law judge is an attorney who has applied and is vetted through Office of Personnel Management. There's four levels process to get to be an administrative law judge. There's over 233 hearing offices in the United States and the territories. Depending on the size of the area, would depend on the number of judges that they have. So, for instance, the Seven Fields Hearing Office down the street from my office, it serves basically Indiana, Armstrong, Butler, Beaver, Lawrence, all the way up to Erie. We actually pull in Mahoning County over in Ohio as well.
It's in the Youngstown area.
Youngstown. We have currently 11 administrative law judges. Mm-hmm. Some of the big cities have 30, 40, 50 in some of the rural areas, like, you know, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, maybe have one or two. But they're appointments by life. They are pretty neutral.
But they do work for the government.
They do work for the government. What's interesting, just as a quick aside, they're unionized, which I find interesting that administrative law judges have their own, for Social Security, have their own mm-hmm. union.
Hmm. Well, air traffic controllers are unionized too.
Right.
Employees of the federal government. I'm looking down through my notes here. We're chatting, by the way, with Elizabeth Smith, whose law practice focuses a tremendous amount on Social Security issues. If you have a question or comment, you can feel free to join us. I'll try to get to your calls. Hopefully it won't keep you waiting too much longer. In fact, let's take one right now. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Smith. Go right ahead.
Yes, I was going to talk about the death benefits. Could she tell you, I know they're real low, but I think it's $250, but is there a ruling about head of household or something with that?
Well, let's start from the beginning here, because what's a death benefit, first of all, Attorney Smith? What?
That would be when any individual passes away, Social Security pays a small sum to the next of kin.
Anybody? I didn't realize
And it's like $250-some.
Mm-hmm. Was that your question, sir? What's the amount?
Yeah, but the other thing is one thing I was... does everybody that passes away... In fact, what I was thinking about is my wife passed away, and I did not get the $250 because they said that I was the head of the household. Is that true?
Depend on earnings. Did you earn more than she did?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that would be my understanding then.
Okay. So, but then if I pass away, the next of kin should get the $250.
If you have a spouse, or if you have my understanding is if you have minors, it wouldn't be for adult children.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. that's what I didn't understand.
It's, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be to a third cousin or whatever mm-hmm. or something like mm-hmm. that.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah, good question. I wasn't even aware of that. Is that, do you have to apply for that, or is that paid automatically by the government?
They typically call when the death certificate comes through and... Mm-hmm. Or typically, I find that funeral homes will notify families that that's a benefit that's available.
In today's day and age, though, I mean, that's almost a pittance, isn't it?
Right.
$250.
Yeah, back in the 60s, that paid for something.
Yeah.
These days, it doesn't.
And back in the 40s, whenever Social Security came into being, paid for a lot, but
right.
not so much anymore. I also am looking at my notes here. By the way, folks, 283-2525, our number, 283-2525. Did I hear you say that it's quite possible that both a husband and a wife could be on SSI at the same time?
Yes.
That's not uncommon?
Not uncommon. The amount, again... Double check those amounts for this year.
I don't mean to make you look through your tables. I'm
Nope. So in 2018, a couple would be paid $1,125 a month, and in 2019, $1,157. But if you have, you know, a couple and they are both disabled and low income, that they are eligible. One other thing to point out, too, is that you know, Social Security recognizes same-sex marriages. So mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's husband and wife or wife and wife. It's you know, the Social Security Administration treats all couples, married couples, the same.
Why is it that it's more difficult to successfully get a claim if you're younger? Because you mentioned this, if you're under 50, it's pretty tough.
The rules, in no better terms, the rules kind of loosen up when you're 50 to 54. So if you have a physical limitation and you're limited to sedentary work and you're 50 to 54, you can have a finding of disabled. If you are, that's light work at 50 to 54. And if you're 55 and above, you can have a finding of disabled. But when you're under 50, judges will say that the person can do light work, or they can do some level of sedentary work. Mm-hmm. So in absent some type of objective findings that show that a person has certain functional limitations, they're not going to have a finding of disabled.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. It's been very educational, by the way, today. I really appreciate you talking about this. But say you were doing, and I don't know what kind of work, so you were doing something classified as heavy work, okay? Mm-hmm. And you became disabled and weren't able to do that again. But if the administrative law judge deemed that you were capable of doing lighter work, you might not have been able to do what you were doing before, but you could do something else, then you're not going to be able to get a disability claim, right?
Maybe. Depends on your age.
This is always so complex. Well, that's why when you get to this stage, that's why people need an attorney to help them get through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I wanted to be sure and mention is Social Security Administration for a number of years did not recognize fibromyalgia cases. And although it's not recognized as a listing, Social Security has a mandate out there about how exactly they examine and look at fibromyalgia cases. And excuse me, one of the items that I make sure that I tell my claimants is when they go to see their rheumatologist, that the tender points, there's 18 tender points, be sure that your doctor is marking down how many positive tender points you have. I've won multiple cases because if you have 12 out of 18 tender points consistently over a period of time, you're going to have a finding of disabled. Where just a few years ago, administrative law judges and the administration didn't want to touch fibromyalgia cases. Fibromyalgia cases, pain cases, seizure cases, those are pretty difficult cases to win.
Fibromyalgia, that's general
joint
muscle weakness, joint pain, so
right.
on and so forth.
Fatigue, mm-hmm. right.
What I know about it is from the drug commercials you see on TV. I don't know much else. A little bit difficult to diagnose, I suppose. That's one reason.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, I don't want to make sweeping generalizations here, but do people try to scam the Social Security Administration in these areas? They try to hoodwink them, try to pull the wool over their eyes. I'm trying to think of all the old bromides here. Do they try to scam them?
Sure. I mean, aren't there scammers in the world?
Yes.
And if there's money involved or benefit involved, sure. One of the things, again, when someone comes in to see me is I have an ethical obligation to pursue claims that only have merit. But even at that, have I been scammed, so to speak? Probably. Mm-hmm. Have I seen some cases where somebody's done a real good job? Sure. I think they're far and few between. And one of the things, oftentimes I'll have clients sit and talk to me and they'll say, yeah, my neighbor down the street, like he lit off fireworks on the 4th of July, but yet he's on Social Security disability. But the question is, what's he on Social Security disability for? can you see it? Do you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it a mental health claim? Is it something, some level of some incurable disease? You know, you don't know.
Yeah. Have you had to tell clients occasionally, or potential clients, that you don't think that they really have a claim?
Sure. I probably, when someone contacts our office, we do an initial evaluation, and we probably only meet with 80% of the people who call in.
Okay.
And of those people, I take probably 2 out of 3.
Mm-hmm. So there's kind of an initial evaluation there.
Right. Mm-hmm. But understand that another attorney may have a different opinion, and oftentimes they go and get another opinion.
We have another caller, 283-2525. Caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Elizabeth Smith.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Just fine. How are you today?
I am very good. I know Elizabeth. She's a good attorney. And I just have a simple question. When you are on Social Security disability, now, how much money are you allowed to make on the side without it reducing your amount of disability?
That's a great question. Yeah, great question.
It's going to depend on what your monthly benefit is. So we would need to know what your monthly benefit is to make a determination on terms of what you can receive.
Is that information available on the website that you were talking about earlier? Or no.
I don't believe so. Typically, that's a call to the local office.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's about as specific as we could be, caller. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And to you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Good questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, as our time begins to run short here, we should mention that, people who weren't with us at the beginning of our conversation, you said the website for the Social Security Administration is a fantastic one.
It is. It's one of the best I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And it's... I think I copied it down correctly. SSA.gov, is that right?
Correct.
Is it, how do I put this, Elizabeth? I got on a website last week, somebody told me, and it was the most complicated thing I've ever seen. I couldn't figure it out. Is it accessible?
It's very accessible. The one thing I will tell you is if you want to appeal the first decision, unfavorable decision, they kind of hide that button.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of trying to find your earnings statement, in terms of filing some of the other appeals, pretty easy to find. I've found even my, I call them computer illiterate clients, and I'll bring them in and help them fill something out, mm-hmm. that they're able to navigate through it.
Oh, well, pretty accessible then. Gosh, I do want to thank you. You've certainly enlightened me a great deal in this area, and I'm sure many of our listeners as well. Elizabeth Smith, a local attorney, her practice focuses a great deal on Social Security issues, and your practice is in Cranberry, you said?
Yeah, my main office is in Cranberry, and I have a satellite here in Butler.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks again for chatting with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, very informative. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to be switching gears a little bit. We're going to be talking about holiday-friendly health tips for your gut. Who doesn't overeat over the holidays? Who doesn't like to have a big ham dinner and then, you know, open up the top button on your jeans and sit back on the couch and not the best thing to do, I don't think. Listen, we're going to talk about this with a person who knows what she's talking about, Dr. Samantha Nazareth, who is a gastroenterologist, and she visits with us in just a couple of minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be back momentarily.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
It's Winter Supply Month at Osterling's Lawn and Garden. Stop in for heated waterers for rabbits to livestock, Lignetics wood pellets, heaters for bird baths, muck boots, Nebo flashlights, and oil lanterns, and hand and foot warmers too. Get ready for the snow with Pet Safe Ice Melt, rock salt, calcium chloride flakes or pellets, snow shovels, and ice scrapers. You can find it all at Osterling's Lawn and Garden at the corner of Monroe and Jefferson Streets in Butler.
Coming up, listeners, on the next segment of the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. We're going to get some holiday-friendly gut health tips, and that's something that I think most of us can use during the holiday period. Listen, folks, if you're an adult and experiencing recurring symptoms of constipation, you may suffer from something called irritable bowel syndrome, or perhaps something called chronic idiopathic constipation. Now, talking with your doctor is really the only way to get an accurate diagnosis and get treatment, but we're going to find out a little bit about these problems today with our guest who visits with us on the telephone. She is a gastroenterologist, Dr. Samantha Nazareth. Dr. Nazareth, nice to have you with us here today.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to share any information with your listeners.
Also with us on the line is an IBS patient of Dr. Nazareth, and that's Blanca. Blanca, nice to have you with us here as well.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited about having this conversation as well.
Well, Dr. Nazareth, I used some pretty big words there in my introduction. Maybe we better start out
Dave,
by...
Dave, you did a pretty good job.
I want to start out by making sure everybody knows just what we're talking about when we say IBS and CIC. So tell us a little bit about what first of all, is IBS, irritable bowel syndrome?
And specifically IBS-C, so... IBS-C is irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, and CIC, as you said perfectly, chronic idiopathic constipation. And as you can surmise or assume, the constipation is a component of both of them, as it's in the name.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest distinction is really, do I have belly pain? Do I have belly discomfort? Because that really takes us to the diagnosis of IBS-C. And these two conditions are things that happen chronically. So it's not just like a one-off thing where, oh, you know, my bowel habits have changed slightly. This is something that's happening for more than 3 months, and it keeps coming back. And Dave, like, this really affects a lot of people. 13 million adults have IBS-C, and 35 million people, adults, have CIC.
More than I would have realized. Now, we're in the holiday season here, and that's when a lot of people, let's face it, they tend to overdo it a little bit. They tend to overeat. Does that present more significant problems, Doc?
Yeah, because I think it, you know, the holiday season gets a little people off their pattern. Like, we're not eating the same way. We're not doing the same things that we've been doing all throughout the year. And yet, like, these, it's basically 6 weeks of a different lifestyle. And so with that, I always give 3 tips to my patients. One, make sure you stay hydrated, because we're up and about doing like shopping and attending events, and we need more water. Secondly, make sure to get fiber in, leafy greens, veggies, all those things. And thirdly is make sure to keep moving. Because as you keep moving, things inside of us keep moving from north to south.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk to Blanca a little bit. Blanca is a patient of Dr. Nazareth. Blanca, what prompted you to talk to your doctor about your symptoms?
Great question, Dave. For me, it was a very difficult conversation to have. I had been suffering with these symptoms for 9 years. I equated it to maybe that's just how life is supposed to go. With that, I realized that it was taking a lot of time away from my family. So I'd be in the bathroom sometimes for an hour at a time, and I said, enough is enough. And it made me really think about my daughter specifically. So she's 9, and I thought, if she had any of these symptoms, I wouldn't hesitate to have this conversation or seek medical assistance. That's really the biggest factor that drove me to see my doctor to have that difficult conversation, because nobody wants to discuss their bowel movements with anybody, and let alone with somebody that you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the easiest thing to talk about. Dr. Nazareth, are there treatments available for adults who suffer from these conditions?
Yeah, there are treatments, and I've partnered with Allergan and Ironwood as a paid spokesperson to discuss one treatment option, which is Linzess. And Linzess is once daily. It's not a laxative, because that's something that I always get asked a lot about in my practice. And get to the doctor just to have a conversation. Some of the side effects of Linzess can include diarrhea, gas, belly swelling, but it's really appropriate to speak to a physician to figure out what's the best fit for you, you know, your specific symptoms and your specific situation.
So it's not just a case of using a laxative. Actually, from what I don't have any medical training, but there are different types of laxatives too, aren't they? Some of them work differently than others?
Yeah, that's right. And that's why a lot of people ask me about that question in regards to Linzess, because laxatives really are meant for long-term usage. And these two conditions are something that are chronic, so people have these symptoms for more than 3 months.
And you said, Blanca, my goodness, did you say you suffered from this for several years?
9 years. 9 years before I sought medical assistance.
Wow. So once you were diagnosed, what did you do? What step did you take to try to manage the condition?
In my situation, together, of course, with the treatment that I came, you know, that we worked out with my doctor, it was super important for me to stay hydrated, like she mentioned before. So the hydration was key. Fiber intake, I upped my fiber intake, and that really helped me get ahead of those symptoms as well. And then also, of course, the exercise. I've always been a very active person, but really the exercise and keep on moving, especially to keep, your appetite really in check. It really helps out. So that, to me, worked for me anyway.
Not easy to do over the holidays, especially. Mm-hmm. Doctor, I can remember when I was a kid hearing about drinking 8 glasses of water today. I always thought that was impossible to drink 8 glasses of water. Actually, these days, I do drink a lot more water because I cut out sugary drinks a few years ago. But is there any, are they still talking about 8 glasses of water today? Or what's the optimum amount?
It's so hard to say what's the optimum amount because, one, you have to take into account, are you exercising, what's your body weight? There's all these other factors that determine what's proper hydration. I think, the 8 glasses is sort of a general thing that someone can start with, but obviously if you're thirsty, that means, you have to drink some water.
Mm-hmm. Fill up on fiber, one of the other things you recommended. So I know about fiber, vegetables, stuff like that. Are there other foods that we can eat that will help us to fill up on fiber other than leafy vegetables?
Whole grains too, legumes, beans, lentils, that sort of thing. Those are great fiber sources, along with the leafy greens. What we're so used to seeing in salads like spinach and kale and collard greens.
Are there any foods that you should specifically avoid if you're having these problems?
Yeah, you mentioned the sugary drinks. Sugar is really, I think it's the biggest problem when we get into the holiday season because it's everywhere and it's so easy to indulge and keep going with it. I think that just being proactive and realizing like, oh, we're going into holiday season, this might be a problem, let me do these 3 tips and keep on it, just so I can keep things moving and keep regular.
You mentioned trying to stick to your routine. This is not easy. Sometimes we're visiting, we're going to open houses and parties and visiting relatives for meals and so on and so forth. Hard to stick with your routine. And then, of course, there's travel, too. A lot of folks experience these difficulties whenever they're traveling a long distance by car, for example, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is what I say, like people are on planes, trains, automobiles for most of the holiday season, but that's why it's important to keep moving and keep active. Once you get out of that car, get out of that plane, making sure to keep moving and not just stay on the couch all day.
But it's so easy, Doctor.
And then,
Blanca, you could back me up on this. You know, you finish a big, whatever your particular holiday meal is. In our family, it was always ham at Christmas time. You finish a big meal, the first thing you want to do is pop that top button on, on your trousers and sit down in the recliner and, you know, watch TV or something like that. Not the best idea, eh?
That is correct, absolutely. And just to kind of throw this out there as well, they've for anybody that's out there that's listening, that you know where this resonates with them, they can all go to www.linzess.com. There's a lot of really great resources if you feel like you might have some of these symptoms.
Terrific. Well, thanks for talking about it, Blanca, and Dr. Nazareth, too. Nice to have you with us here today. Thank you.
Yeah, happy holidays.
And to you. Sure. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Still fishing for the perfect holiday gift? Why not give the gift of fishing? 2019 fishing licenses are available now at GoneFishingPA.com. Don't get snagged searching stores. Go to GoneFishingPA.com and choose a fishing license voucher for your favorite angler. The thrill of the catch, outdoor fun with family and friends, that's fishing. Save when you choose a multi-year fishing license. Buy your license or vouchers today at GoneFishingPA.com. And happy holidays from the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission.
For most kids, the glass is half full. They have access to fresh milk, a vital source of calcium, potassium, and protein. But for one in six kids in Pennsylvania, the glass is half empty. They face hunger and malnutrition. By supporting the Fill a Glass with Hope program, you can help bring fresh milk to Pennsylvania food banks so every kid can have what every kid deserves, a full life. Please donate at feedingpa.org/milk. Brought to you by the American Dairy Association Northeast, Pennsylvania Dairymen's Association, and Feeding PA.
A lot of concern these days, listeners, about kids especially spending too much time with their digital device. That would apply to adults, too, I think, who always have their face in a screen. Well, there's an upside to digital devices, and that's what we're going to talk about on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest visiting with us here today is Nicole Dreiske, the author of The Upside of Digital Devices. Nicole, hello. Nice to have you with us here today.
Oh, good afternoon.
I'm correct on the fact that a lot of parents are concerned that their kids are spending too much time with their faces in a screen, right?
Yes. I mean, this has been going on for a couple of decades, actually, because parents have been worried about the impact of technology on children, especially in early childhood, for quite a while. And, you know, now the tech insiders are outing software creators for making their products purposely addictive. And did you know that the World Health Organization just classified addiction to gaming as an actual disease?
I did not.
So this is a big issue now. And parents are looking for solutions. And what I did was ask a few really critical questions for a couple of years. And the first question, and I think it indicates where I'm going with the upside. The first question is, what does a great relationship to these technologies look like? What does a great relationship to digital devices look like for you, for your child? How can we make these devices serve them, you know, developmentally and educationally? Well, you know what happened, Dave, was the parents had a whole lot of ideas around that.
Mm-hmm.
They really did. And so did teachers. And so parents, for example, came up with this, well, wait a minute, you know, if my child gets really upset by something or really concerned by something, I'd like him to come to me and talk to me about it. That's not what's happening. That's why the doctors, the American Academy of Pediatrics, had me teach a workshop for the doctors to teach them how to talk to parents about engaging their children in discussion and dialogue about these devices and about how they're reacting to technology. So, but teachers, if you think about what they want, they're doing all this work with literacy, they're teaching the kids to read. They were just hoping that when the kids get home, instead of dropping the awareness of, well, character, plot, setting, mm-hmm. that kids would actually look at the screens, whether it's a game, there's often a story in a game, or a YouTube video, there's stories in movies. If you can just leverage some of the great work teachers are doing in schools and get kids to turn on their minds while they're watching, you can actually boost learning. So after talking and getting that wish list together, I went into, more than a dozen schools for 7 years to test these approaches, these ways of talking to kids. And you know what we came up with? This was the most fun we ever had. I could predict that there would be an uptick in literacy skills, and I could predict that kids would really enjoy communicating about what they were watching on screens and how they were using their screens. I love to talk about it. We just don't give them a place to do that. What I couldn't predict, Dave, was that tiny children would go home and tell their parents to turn off the TV. Wow. That was not my goal. My goal was just to get the dialogue started. But what children were doing by talking about what they liked and what they didn't like and why was they were developing a whole set of filters for what they like, for what they really should and should not be watching. And they were making better viewing choices. How about that? That was one of the things on the wish list.
Well, this is interesting because most parents would see that the other way around, that, you know, they're the ones that are responsible for creating filters and controls. You say give the kids a chance.
Controls and filters are different.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is that's a lot of pressure to put on parents, Dave. It really is. I mean, since television has been out, what are the two things that parents have been told to do? Watch everything with them or turn it off. And who can do that today? It's almost impossible. So the point is that we actually have control in the sense that they love us. We feed them. We clothe them. We live with them. They would like to talk to us. But what we're doing right now is segregating screen time. Now think about it. In all the families who are working really hard to balance this, what they're doing is segregating screen time so that, there are these active things that we do. There's soccer and there's, going to the zoo and there's painting and dance and all of those things that you're having your kids do. And then you'll allocate, 30 minutes, an hour of time with a screen alone. But over time, you're talking about 1,400 hours a year. That's what even our youngest kids are spending with screens. That's how much time they're spending with screens. And they're only spending 900 hours a year in school. So you can't have 1,400 hours be what I lovingly call, quote, the adult-free zone, unquote. Even if you've picked the content that they're watching, you have no finger on the pulse of what they're really feeling and thinking. And that's where the good stuff is. We need to know, and they need to want to talk to us about what they're feeling and thinking, because this is the most powerful influence in their lives. And if we're not part of that, we're ultimately moving forward, not part of the child's life. It's a big deal.
In addition to taking steps that allow kids to build their own filters, their own controls, you also talk in your book, Nicole, about how to enhance a youngster's vocabulary and communication by talking with them about what they're watching.
Yeah, this is such a great way to fill that 30-million-word gap that Risley and Hart talked about. This was a study that came out where they were charting the loss of communications between parents and kids, largely as a result of screens, because we're on our screens, they're on theirs, we're not talking. And one of the things that needs to happen to build vocabulary is to talk to your children. And you know where the best place is to do that and where you do it all the time and communicate constantly is when you're reading a bedtime story aloud to a child. Mm-hmm. See, that I think that's the the real, let's call it the magic, is that parents already have these skills, Dave. I'm not asking them to do anything or suggesting that they do anything that's not in their skill set. I'm just asking them to extend that skill set some of the time to screen time. And so let's look at the skill set of reading a bedtime story. Do you motor mouth through? No. What do you do when you're reading a story to a child? You're using a tone that's light, that's inviting. You're giggling, you're cuddling, you're pointing out differences in the pictures from page to page. Sometimes, by the third or fourth reading of the same story, children will build whole sub-stories about what that character could be doing. You're connecting certain characters to things they've seen on the playground or things they've seen in school. It's interactive, and that builds vocabulary. But think about it. If you did that just a couple of times a week with a story-based app or a game that has a narrative built into it, or, hey, you can do it with SpongeBob. you can do it. Please don't do it with Frozen. It takes too long. But you can do it with all kinds of short media on YouTube. We call it Screen Talk, and it is a place where children flourish because we never give them a chance to talk about what they're really thinking about what they're doing with screens. That's all just inside them. And we need a chance to hear it and interact with them around it. And then when they do see something that's scary or when they do wander into a part of the internet that is toxic, they'll come to us. They'll talk to us. That's what we want.
We have to take a quick break here, folks. We have a few more minutes that we're able to talk with Nicole Dreisky. We'll pick up our conversation with her here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 6363. The pick 3, 828, 828. The pick 4, 8557. Pick 5, 71052. Wild ball for each of those is 2. The treasure hunt, 3, 7, 9, 26, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. I'd like to talk to you for just a moment here about the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. What a great job they do to help those who are less fortunate in many ways. They operate the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, of course. They have their St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart and their client aid program. And the client aid program helps needy families or individuals, maybe with help on a heating bill or a rent payment at the end of the month, client aid. And that's funded through the operation of the thrift store. So you can help by donating items that you no longer need or want to the thrift store. It's very easy to do. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. You can use the container outside. They're located in the Greater Butler Mart, so think about it. Next time you're cleaning the closet or the upstairs, instead of throwing that stuff away, why not donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler? We stand tallest when we stoop to help others.
Have you been keeping up with your Armco Credit Union Christmas Club contributions this year? If not, that's okay, because they can help you manage those holiday expenses. The Armco Credit Union is offering holiday loans with a low 9.5% fixed APR, which comes with a 12-month term, meaning your holiday expenses will be paid off by next year. Take advantage of this offer now through December 31st. Learn more at armcocu.com. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome back. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, that's fine. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Nicole Dreisky, and we're talking about her book, The Upside of Digital Devices, How to Make Your Child More Screen Smart, Literate, and Emotionally Intelligent. A little bit about our guest. Nicole Dreisky has 40 years' experience in developing cutting-edge educational strategies. She has addressed the World Summit on Media and the National Association for the Education of Young Children, and she is now the executive director of the International Children's Media Center. So what I'm taking, one of the messages from your book, Nicole, is that, and this doesn't apply only to kids, adults. I know sometimes when I'm looking at YouTube, it's just kind of mindless, you know. I'm just kind of
right. Putting
the time right. In. You say, don't be mindless. Teach your kids to be mindful whenever they're, for example, watching YouTube, right?
Yes, when you're using a screen. And it's such a simple thing to change, and it's rooted in brain chemistry. Let's think about it this way, because the part of the brain that's active when you're mindlessly watching a screen is the lower reptilian brainstem, the most primitive, emotionally reactive part of the brain. Well, think about it. I mean, spending 1,400 hours a year when your brain is developing with only one part of your brain can't be good for kids. It just can't be. You don't have to be a scientist to figure that out. And so for us, what we need to do is have intention. I'm talking about adults. The same thing for kids. We need to have intention before we turn on the screen. In brief, we would say turn on the mind before turning on the screen. That's how you get to mindful viewing. And intention or real purpose are the best safeguards against mindlessness, against getting sucked into whatever is on the screen. I think the real issue is that we have a cycle going. You know, we've got veg, game, binge, work. And those aren't necessarily the best for us. So you have to make some choices about how you want to spend your time. You have to make some choices about what you want to do with your mind while you're watching or while you're using a screen. Now, work is, we could all say, separate, all right, because we've got to earn a living, we've got to work on these things, sure. But sometimes you need to decompress. I think I say in the book, you know, that I have friends who spent months watching whole shows, you know, years of shows, and came out the other side feeling great. But doing it as a matter of course, because it's there, compresses our outlook, compresses our emotions, and makes us feel as if we're out of control. And that's simply not the case, Dave. Good grief. These things are machines. This is a machine. It was created to serve me. I use it as I need it. There are some things that I'm going to be entertained by, but it's not an extension of me. It's a tool. More importantly, and let's put it this way, it's a servant, not a master.
Hmm. One final question before our time runs out here, Nicole.
Sure.
You can never start too early. I can remember a few years back, you'd see, an 8 or 9 year old kid with a screen, while you're in line at Walmart or whatever.
Right.
Now it's younger than that. I mean, I see 4 and 5 year olds. They've got their nose in a screen.
Yes. Yes. And this, again, we're conducting a vast social experiment without anybody collecting developmental data except after the case. That's the problem. The passback phenomenon, handing children really what is arguably the most powerful device ever created, is something that is extremely damaging, done as a matter of course. I think, you know, let's make it short. Let's make it simple. I've got some top tips for being screen smart when you start tiny. Just before you press play, prime the child's mind for a fun way of using screens. And so just say, look, we're going to do something special. We're going to watch and play together, and we're going to look for what we like and what we don't like and why. And that is every bit as much fun as anything else you'll ever do with a child. You just have to, again, extend the fun of your normal interactions with kids to screen time some of the time. So it's included, so it's not segregated and sedentary. Okay, next, just get into the habit of using your storybook voice when you're talking with children around screens and around screen time. The problem, the reason parents have a little bit of trouble reaching over the divide is that usually they're using their directive or instructional voice to children,
yes.
As in, turn that off and go outside. Okay, so
we all know that voice, yes.
Yep, and that's not good for dialogue. And just interact and talk during screen time some of the time. When we watch or play with screens together, we give our children a totally new experience with screen time. You don't have to watch everything with your child. Just share the experience once or twice a week, and then point out ideas, point out details, and share ideas. Ask questions. You know, with it, when they're tiny, point out the colors and the shapes and the characters. And what you're doing is opening a door that says, Mommy cares about what I'm thinking. Mommy cares about what I'm feeling. Okay, when I run into things that I'm not understanding, I'm going to go to Mommy. I'm going to go to Daddy. I'm going to talk to them. We don't want them turning to the two-year-olds next to them for advice. It's really not constructive. So we can get closer to our kids and help them be good digital citizens and thrive in this new world by turning on their minds before turning on the screens.
She is Nicole Dreiske. She is the author.